ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Our particular neighbourhood in space, the Milky Way galaxy, is made up of billions of stars with a supermassive black hole in the centre. It's ringed by a swathe of old yellow stars and surrounded by young blue stars that spiral out from the centre, lined with dark lanes of dust. The Milky Way was named for a Greek myth about a goddess who sprayed milk across the sky. In Chinese, it's known as the Silver River. In Afrikaans, it's called the Heavenly Street. In Mongolian, the Heavenly Seam. Naomi McClure-Griffiths is an astrophysicist who looks up at the Milky Way from our tiny little rocky planetary platform on the galaxy's outer rim. When Naomi first began as an astrophysicist, she found bubbles in space that had never been recorded before. And a few years later, while creating an atlas of the Milky Way, Naomi realized she'd come across something no one had identified before, which was an entirely new spiral arm of our galaxy. Well done, you, Naomi. Hello.
Hello.
I'm going to ask you my 10-year-old questions because this sort of stuff always inspires my inner 10-year-old. Can you tell me why stars throughout the universe are clustered together in galaxies rather than spaced more or less evenly through space like they appear at the start of Star Wars movies?
The Star Wars movies are a terrible analogy for us, aren't they?
They are.
So gravity is the key element here. So gravity is what pulls the stars together. And once you have some small bit of gravity, sort of an overdensity of stars, you start to get more and more and more, and that brings them together.
The supermassive black hole I mentioned at the start there, is that exerting some kind of centripetal force that's like sort of water going down the plug hole?
Sort of, yes. I mean, we tend to get excited about black holes, but so we think, you know, everything spirals into a black hole and it's all going to disappear and suck everything in. But our black hole at the center of our own galaxy is kind of piddly. it's by galactic standards, not all that exciting. And if you replaced it with, you know, a million stars, you wouldn't know the difference. So it does have an influence, but only in its really nearby neighborhood.
Is that the thing that gives the spiral galaxy its spiral shape?
No, it's not. Actually, what causes spiral shapes in galaxies is a little bit of a fraught area. But what particularly causes it is that they are spinning, and they're spinning for the same reason that, you know, if you take an ice skater who's got their arms out, when they bring their arms in, they spin faster. And the same thing happens with these galaxies when they're forming. As all of the stars come in, they start to spin faster. And you get a little tiny perturbation just for, you know, small random reasons. And it sends this wave through the galaxy. And the spiral arms are actually a wave that's slowly moving through the galaxy.
Just back to that supermassive black hole, because I'm struggling to think of it as piddly just quietly. Is the power of such a black hole able to distort space and time?
Yes, it is. All black holes, and even our, you know, piddly one, and I shouldn't have disparaged it, they do distort space and time, and you get a sort of weird, imagine like a funnel effect around the black hole where the gravity is bent and the time does weird things. But it really is in a very, very small area right around the black hole. But there are stars that are nearby that are orbiting that black hole and moving incredibly fast. And in fact, you can find movies of them on the web which show these stars zipping around the area around the black hole.
Is the Milky Way itself, just zooming out even further here, is the Milky Way galaxy actually part of a larger group, a kind of galaxy of galaxies?
It's part of what's called the local group of galaxies. So, yes, it is. Most galaxies are in groups or in clusters, and our own local group has our galaxy and Andromeda as the sort of two big bullies, and then a whole bunch of little dwarf galaxies, which are much less massive than our own galaxy, which are interacting with ours and with Andromeda.
One of the things that's been hardest for me to get over from my childhood with science fiction and comic books is the idea of just how vastly, profoundly, and utterly empty so much of space is, Naomi. I think, you know, growing up, I imagined that we'd be getting in spaceships and hopping from planet to planet like we would, like from a ship from island to island. But I read the other day that if our entire solar system was the size of just a 10-cent piece, the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, would be the size of the entirety of Australia. Is the space between these things, these objects in space, so utterly empty? Is there anything at all that's floating around between these interstellar systems, Naomi?
There is a little bit of stuff in between the stars, and that's the stuff that actually gets me really excited. I mean, the stars are cool and they look pretty, but it's the gas between the stars that I love. But there isn't much of it. On average, there's about one atom per cubic centimeter. So the analogy I like to give is that if you ran from Earth to the nearest star with a butterfly net the size of a football field, you would collect a gram of material.
That's it. That's all you get. These galaxies you were speaking of, ours and the Andromeda Galaxy, as they sort of float through space in the basic vicinity of each other, do they ever crash into each other?
Yeah, they do. It's spectacular. I mean, it's slow moving. It doesn't happen over years. It happens over millions of years. But galaxies do crash into each other. And when they do, they trigger bursts of star formation. So suddenly a whole bunch of new stars are born in these areas where galaxies collide. Their black holes can end up interacting with each other and merging into another bigger black hole. And in fact, that's how our pathetic little black hole has formed. So yeah, galaxies do interact, but as you say, there's so much space between just the stars and our own galaxy. There's even more space between the galaxies themselves. So interactions are few and far between.
Oh, so it's not like I'm imagining like a whole lot of billiard balls crashing into each other, but it's more like two clouds meeting then, is it?
Yeah, two clouds is a good way to think about it. They sort of slide up to each other and slither through.
I know astronomers like you, astrophysicists, can't sit around all day open-mouthed at the wonder of it all, Naomi. I know you've got to get on with your work at some point, but do you still feel the wonder of all this work anyway?
I absolutely feel the wonder. I mean, being an astronomer is like a constant voyage of discovery. So you're always finding new things, and every time you find something new, it does bring that sort of, as you called it, your inner 10-year-old out with this little leap of excitement that you've seen something that nobody else has seen before. But most of the time, it's true, we do kind of like delve into the details that nobody would really care about because we have to get on with it.
I've lived in cities nearly all my life, and when I've gone out into outback Queensland or parts of outback Australia and had the privilege of being out there under the open sky on a clear night, you can see the whole thing, the whole majesty of the Milky Way sort of unfolding before you. Were you able to do that where you grew up, Naomi?
Not a lot. I lived in cities, and I also I lived in Portland, Oregon, which if you've ever been to is probably one of the cloudiest places there is. But we did get out of town. I remember an occasion where we got out into eastern Oregon where it's kind of desert and dry, and I remember looking up at the stars and thinking, my God, what is that? But then I came to the Southern Hemisphere, and it's a whole nother ballgame down here. It's so much more interesting than it is in the North.
Why is it more interesting?
So in the South, we look into the center of the Milky Way. So, you know, we're looking to the CBD. And in the Northern Hemisphere, you look out to the sort of boring old burbs, and it's not nearly as exciting up there.
You moved to Portland, Oregon when you were small in the year 1980. Tell me about the major gigantic geological event that was taking place as you were moving to Portland, please, Naomi.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. Bad luck. We moved to Portland from Atlanta, Georgia on May 18th, 1980, which is the day that Mount St. Helens erupted, completely blew its top. And we were flying across country. We actually flew past Mount St. Helens. We could see it out of the airplane window. My parents like to tell a story that the whole plane sort of tipped over as everybody ran to one side to look at the explosion. And then we landed in Portland and had to cope with ash and the sort of outflow from the eruption.
Was it like arriving in an apocalypse then?
That's my recollection of it. And my mother talked about it as being that way. I think she was particularly miserable to have left the warm, cozy South to arrive into the Pacific Northwest with its perpetually gray skies. And then more than that, there was ash falling from the sky. It was landing on car windows. You couldn't go outside. It was a pretty dreadful time, I think.
Could you breathe outside?
Yeah, we only had a couple of days where things were really nasty in Portland, but we did have to wear masks. It was like, you know, 2020 in like we were all dealing with during the COVID epidemic, but we were doing this in 1980.
When you were at school, were you that kid that loves maths?
I was that kid that loves maths. I love the fact that with maths, there's a right and a wrong. Like, you can do the right thing, and I liked that. So I would blow onto the foggy car windows and do arithmetic on the window while we were driving.
You were that kid. That's brilliant. I love those kids because you're not groovy when you're that kid, are you?
But no, you're definitely not groovy. Nobody else loves those kids. But I like the logic. I like the clarity of it. You know, for the same reason I liked learning languages, because you have the same, there's rules and you follow those rules and you come up to the end answer, and I like that.
Yeah, maths is a language, isn't it? It's a descriptive language, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a universal one, though, that's the thing.
That's the beauty of it.
So why aren't you a mathematician then? Who was the teacher that drew you towards science instead?
Well, there were several teachers who drew me to science along the way, but Mrs. Tessier was the real winner. I think in Mrs. Tessier's class, when I was probably about 11, we dissected more things than you would care to think about. She showed us totally disgusting videos of surgeries and all kinds of phenomenal things, but she really focused us in on a lot of biology, and I think that kind of opened my eyes to science.
Oh, what kind of surgery are we talking about?
Do you really want to know?
Of course I want to know.
There was a spectacular one that we watched where they needed to do a facial reconstruction of somebody, and they cut the skin of the person's head, peeled the face back, and removed some of the bone.
Wow. And how old were you when you were watching this video?
I think I was 11, but maybe 12.
How was the class reacting to this video?
I was so enraptured with the video, I don't remember the class at all. I just thought it was absolutely phenomenal. I think if you showed it to me now, I'd probably be sick. But as a, you know, curious preteen, it was just, whoa, you can do that?
It's a great way to illustrate that science is compelling to a class that might otherwise find it boring, though, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think at that age, you know, the preteens, they're still so curious. You're so into, like, what is that? How does it work? With everything. And so all you need to do is to grab that curiosity and run with it. And I was lucky enough to have a few science teachers who saw my curiosity and helped me run with it.
Yeah, I would have thought if I was a teacher or an adult standing, you know, keeping an eye on you, you'd be destined for great things. Were you competitive? Did you take part in Science Olympics or whatever they had in Portland, Oregon?
A little bit, but not a lot. So I was part of one Science Olympics sort of thing where we had to drop an egg off of a third-story building and not break it. But I tended not to do a great job in most of these things because I'm not a fast thinker. I'm a slow, ponderous kind of person, and I also don't. You had to take tests to get into them, and I am not a test taker. So I didn't do a lot of these kind of things.
Well, how did you come across cosmology?
Yeah, I didn't come across it until I was at university. And I knew physics when I was in high school, and that was fun. And I like physics because you can explain the world with physics. But when I was at university, I was doing a physics degree, and I had a class that I signed up for, which was cosmology. And I remember telling my dad, I'm going to take cosmology, and he confused it with cosmetology. Thought I was maybe going to do something with hair and makeup.
And you said no, Dad. More like the birth of the universe, actually, right?
Yeah, and I don't think he thought that was actually particularly useful.
So how then did this study bring you to Australia for the first time?
So the professor who taught me that cosmology class, he was going on sabbatical for a year to Australia. He was going to go to Sydney. And he offered me and another student the chance to come with him for 6 months to do research. And I loved the idea, but I couldn't afford it. There was just no way I could scrape together the money to do that. And so I had to say no. And my father, bless him, found the money for me to be able to do that, and bought my airplane ticket. And I came to Sydney for 6 months doing research.
Did you have a realistic expectation of what Australia would be like? Because a lot of people in the United States think there's crocs in the main drag and venomous toads everywhere. Did you have that expectation, or do you have a slightly more realistic expectation?
I had no realistic expectation. I think my entire vision of Australia was based off of Midnight Oil and NXS, which had been influential bands in my teenage years. I thought there would be kangaroos and, you know, all the usual weirdnesses. And it turns out it is just about as weird as I thought it would be.
Well, what are your memories of your first hours arriving in Australia then?
First hours, exhausted, the long flight from Los Angeles, and I was told to meet the professor that I was going to be working with, Dan Steinbring, at Circular Quay, and we would go to the Botanic Gardens. First of all, I didn't know what a key was, so I was looking for K-E-Y.
It's a bit Tolkien-like, isn't it, if you think of it? Go to a circular key, there you will meet.
And we went to the Botanic Gardens, and there were these crazy birds. They were big, they were white, they had yellow bits hanging off the top of them, and they squawked at you. And I'm sure all of you can guess what those were, but those cockatoos, they belong in pet stores in my mind. I couldn't believe it. They scream at you here, but I love them now.
So this led you to Parkes Radio Telescope over the Great Dividing Range. Tell me about going to Parkes for the first time.
I love Parkes. So Parkes is the largest radio telescope in the Southern Hemisphere, still the case. And we drove to Parkes. And if you've ever been out to Parkes, you drive from the town and you sort of go around these nice bends, and there's canola growing in the fields, and it's very picturesque. And then you come around a bend, and suddenly this 64-meter radio telescope just is there on the horizon, standing up on its couple of story high pedestal. And for an astronomer, budding astronomer that I was, it was, I think, really did take my breath away.
I think whenever we hear the word telescope, we imagine you're looking at something, but you're hearing something instead here, aren't you?
Well, kind of. You receive things like you receive radio or TV signals. So you're receiving electromagnetic waves. It's just that they're at wavelengths that are much, much larger than the things that we can see with our eyes. And so we have to use computers to process that, to make images out of it. So it's not quite like hearing. We have a vision of, you know, Jodie Foster in Contact with her headphones on listening for the aliens, but it's not quite like that. There's a lot of computers. You're not standing there with your eye underneath the telescope.
Oh, but you're looking at the sound rather than listening to it then.
Yeah, we're looking at images and sort of spectra that are coming in from the telescope.
What are these sounds emanating from?
So the radio waves come from all kinds of different things. So at the time, what I was studying were pulsars, which are rapidly rotating neutron stars. They're about as massive as our own sun, but they're about 30 kilometers across. So they're extremely dense objects, and they spin around like lighthouses, and they emit radio waves from their lighthouse beam, which we pick up with the telescope. And that's what I was looking at the time.
30 kilometers across isn't very big by space terms, is it?
No.
Why are they spinning, and why are they pulsing?
So they are the remnants of stars, massive stars that have died in a supernova explosion. So they might have been, say, 10 times the mass of our sun. And those stars live fast, die young. They explode in spectacular supernova explosions, and as they do, they collapse. And the remnant of the star, so it kicks off all of this nasty stuff, but the remnant of it collapses down into this very dense object. And again, it's just like our ice skater, once more, the ice skater with their arms out spinning around. As it collapses and brings those arms in, these things speed up when they start spinning around really fast.
So it's something that was once thousands of times at least as large as the Earth, but has now shrunk down to the size of a large town, effectively, and is super dense as a result of that.
Yep, exactly.
And what are you looking at to find out?
So what I was looking at was to see what was between us and the pulsar that I was looking at. So pulsars, because they spin around so regularly, the lighthouse beacons pass through the interstellar gas, and you can learn things about the interstellar gas by the phenomenon of scintillation, which is exactly the reason that you see stars twinkle when you look up at night. They're scintillating. So these really compact objects twinkle, and we were looking at the twinkling to try to understand what was between us and the pulsar itself.
And how old were these twinkles? How old were these bits of light you were seeing, or capturing, I should say, these twinkles that you were capturing while out in parks?
So this one would have been, you know, a few thousands of years since it left the object, because, of course, light has a travel time. So we would have receiving rays that were coming from, you know, 5,000 years ago.
And what are the clouds that are interfering with it, that are making it twinkle?
These are little clouds of ionized gas, of plasma, just electrons and protons floating around.
When you say ionized, do you mean like electrified, something like that?
I mean that the atoms have been split apart, mainly because they get hot. So if you take an atomic hydrogen atom and you make it hot, about 10,000 degrees or so, its electron gets so excited it jumps away from the proton and off it goes and forms a sort of soup of protons and electrons.
And you're actually hearing the signal. You're not actually seeing a flash of light, or are you seeing a flash of light from this pulsar?
It's not light in the visual range that we could see with our eyes, but it is a type of light. It's just light way down lower energy.
Is there something about these pulsars that seem, I don't know, they sound like distress signals or something, from cosmic distress signals from far away?
Well, you know, they were discovered first. People thought they might be aliens because there was this thing that was going beep, 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 and carrying on. And when Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who first discovered these during her PhD, there was jokes that they were little green men. But no, they're not distress signals. They're just a consequence of the way that stars die. And there's thousands of them scattered throughout our galaxy.
So this has led you to your own area of specialization, which is the stuff between the stars.
It has indeed. The stuff between the stars is the critical stuff.
Now we know that there's a vast amount of dark matter or dark energy, which is the, I think, is the name for what we don't know, really, rather than what we do know. How does that play into your work?
Well, not so much dark energy in my work. Dark matter certainly sets the rotation of our own galaxy. So when we look at our galaxy and we see the stuff between the stars and we see the stars itself, we can measure how fast it's all rotating. But it's actually rotating faster than you would think it should be because of the amount of mass that's there. And the stuff that you have to infer is the dark matter. So as you said, it's the stuff that, you know, we can't see it, we don't know what it is, so we call it dark. But my own work actually does focus on the things that we can see. So I'm sort of fortunate that I can look at the bits that we can see and look at the hydrogen that's between the stars and try to understand how the galaxy is moving and living. It's sort of a living, breathing entity, and how that changes with time.
So this was the subject of the doctorate you did in the United States at the University of Minnesota, doing a survey of the hydrogen gas and other bits and pieces that are lying between the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Was this in the end leading to you towards creating a kind of a map?
Yeah. So what we were trying to do during my PhD was to make a complete atlas of the hydrogen gas in the Milky Way. And you might think, well, hydrogen gas, okay, whatever. But this is the stuff from which stars form, and it's the stuff to which stars return when they die. So the hydrogen is the kind of key critical element in how galaxies work. And we wanted to know where it all is, how it's moving, and use that to try to understand both the structure of our galaxy, which is kind of hard to understand because we're sitting in the middle of it and we can't walk around or fly above it. And we also wanted to be able to use it to understand how the galaxy evolves.
When I think of hydrogen gas, I think of something really diaphanous, like this kind of a loose cloud that would naturally dissipate. But it is matter. Does it cluster together into clouds through that same process of gravity and gravitic attraction that is working on the galaxy itself?
Yes, it does. Gravity is the key in almost everything in astrophysics, although most of the clouds that I look at are not what we call gravitationally bound. So that means that they can just do what you talked about, like clouds. They sort of change and float away and move as things around them move.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
When you started to make this map, where do you begin to make this vast cosmological atlas, Naomi?
The best place to look when you're starting to make an atlas is to look in the disk of the Milky Way. So the Milky Way, you know, we can see the band of stars across the sky, and that's because we're sitting inside this very sort of flat cylindrical thing. And that's where all the action happens. So the first place to go is to go along that strip where you see most of the stars and to start to map all of the gas through that strip.
This strip you're talking about, is this slightly misleading to look at this strip? Is it a bit like looking at the edge of a CD and not understanding what you're looking at is actually a disc?
Yeah, exactly. So I often use the CD analogies. Like, we're sitting inside that CD, not at the center, a little bit further out. That's the kind of rough proportions of the Milky Way. And you see that strip of gas because you're looking towards the center of the galaxy along that CD. But the real tricky part is that, you know, we can't walk over to the center of the CD and see what's there or move to a different place in it. So we're stuck trying to figure out what the whole forest looks like without being able to move around.
So if we could move somehow to a position, travel the insanely vast distances that would allow us to stand outside and look on top of the Milky Way galaxy, to move from the edge of the CD and look at the big thing from on top, it would be a lot less bright then, wouldn't it? Because what we're looking at, it sounds like, if you're looking at the side of the CD, then that's why it looks so dense with stars, and because it's also clustered along that plane?
Yes, exactly. So we're looking along the plane. If we moved up above it, we'd look down and we would have a lot of empty space that we were looking at and then looking down onto that cluster of all those stars. And furthermore, if we could move around, I'd be out of a job.
So your work really is involved in, I suppose, being able to use science to put your head notionally in that space above the Milky Way galaxy.
Exactly, yeah. So there's been for decades an argument going on. Astronomers argue about the most peculiar things, but we've been arguing about how many spiral arms there are in the Milky Way. And if we could fly above the Milky Way and look down on it, we could just count them and it'd be easy, no problem. But trying to figure this out when you're stuck inside it, the stars that are far away from us are obscured by dust along the way, so we can't even see across most of the galaxy in terms of the stars. It's not an easy problem.
So when we see that beautiful strip in the sky that's given the Milky Way its name, that stripe of stars and matter, it's more than just stars. It's gas and dust as well?
It is stars, gas, and dust. The stars are, in my opinion, they're the boring part. The gas and the dust is the really fun stuff between them, because that's the thing that tells you about what used to be there, and it tells you about where new stars will grow in the future.
What do you mean about what used to be there?
Well, if a star explodes, which they do, so I mean our own star will at some point explode, although because our star is not very big, it won't be terribly interesting when it does. But when big stars explode...
It'd be interesting if you live in the solar system, I think.
Okay, fair enough, yeah. This is a classic astronomer speaking where...
Like, oh my God, the sun's exploding, and the astronomer goes, boring.
Yeah, I should make it clear that when the sun explodes, it won't be good for us here on Earth.
Right. Well, we'll be long gone by then in any case.
Probably will be. But when big stars that are maybe 10 times as massive as our own sun explode, they drive really powerful winds away from them, and it acts like a snowplow to sort of push all the gas away.
So you're trying to create an atlas of the Milky Way galaxy, but from the edge of the CD. How do you begin to even do this?
So the way of creating an atlas that we chose was to use hydrogen gas because it emits radiation in the radio wavelengths, which can move through everything. So you can see all the way across the galaxy when you look in hydrogen gas. You can see to the very far edges, unlike when you're looking with stars. And that's the first valuable choice there. And what we do is slowly take pictures, basically, with the Parkes telescope of the gas, building them up one sort of snapshot at a time as we move along, moving the telescope along the CD of gas, trying to figure out where it all is.
I'm going to just extend the CD metaphor just one last time. Are you like looking at the end of this edge of the CD, trying to guess what tracks are on it effectively?
That's a really nice analogy, actually. I like that a lot. Yeah, we're definitely trying to figure out what the tracks are and where they are all the way across.
So as you're doing this, tell me about the big holes that you found inside these vast swathes of star stuff.
Yeah, so early in my PhD, I found this sort of gap in, you know, taking pictures of all this gas and seeing that it's all nice and coherent, and then there's this big, huge gap where there isn't anything. And the frustrating thing about being a PhD student is that, unlike the rest of your academic career where there's somebody who knows the answer, you reach the PhD phase and nobody knows the answer. So I went to my doctoral supervisor and said, "What's this?" And he said, "I don't know, you figure it out." So I figured out that these bubbles, these places where there was no gas, were formed by the stellar winds and the supernova explosions of hundreds to thousands of massive stars that had lived there maybe 10, 20 million years before. But they're gone now. And all we can see is this fossil that's been left over as a bubble inside the gas distribution.
Are you saying then there was once a star in the middle of that bubble?
There were hundreds of stars in the middle of that bubble.
So they exploded and blew all their particles out, leaving a huge hole.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
How big are these holes?
They can be as much as 1,000 light years across. Most of them are a few hundred light years across. So they're pretty big.
Was it slightly thrilling mapping something new in the galaxy like that?
It's unbelievably thrilling. I mean, this gets your inner explorer going. So when you're looking at something that no one's ever seen before, the waves have come from that part of the space maybe 7,000, 10,000 years before. You've just happened to point your telescope at it and seen what's happening there. And then you figure out what it means. It's really exciting.
Is it a lonely feeling of excitement, given you're traveling into these in your mind and through the research to these big empty spaces?
It is a bit lonely. I mean, I think science often is a somewhat lonely endeavor because you're figuring out something that people haven't figured out before. So you're often sitting kind of at the forefront of leading a wave in some way, and it can be a bit lonely socially, but it can also be a little bit lonely if you think about just how vast space is. So I try not to think about it very often.
And what happens when you talk to people in the general public, people like me, about these things?
Well, you get two reactions when you talk to the general public. You can say you're an astrophysicist and people immediately move away. They don't want to talk to you, or they want to talk about black holes. and so some people, I think a lot of the public has a fascination with, you know, what's out there? Where do we come from? Where are we living? What's going to happen?
I think part of the attraction too is that when Isaac Newton described the universe, he described it as a really predictable, very mechanical place. And that's satisfying in its own way. But ever since Einstein, we've realized how weird the universe is. And maybe that's the reason why the universe is so tantalizing these days, is because we're beginning to apprehend how strange and how largely incomprehensible it is to our little human organic minds.
It's strange, it's largely incomprehensible, and it involves scales that we're not used to thinking about. We're not used to thinking about things in terms of billions of years. We think of things like, well, that was a long time ago. That happened last year. So I think that that really throws us off. It's also very beautiful. You know, my mother was an artist and she could see the beauty in everything. And she often saw the beauty in the scientific world. Because when you look at the universe and you look at, you know, images that are coming out of Hubble or JWST, it's as good as art.
When I read stuff from the ancient and the medieval world, it seems people back then, before they lived in big, bright, illuminated cities as we do today, they were way more familiar with the night sky than we are now. If we live in a city, we rarely see anything other than a light smattering of stars, even at the very best of times. Are you like those ancient and medieval people? Do you have that kind of intimacy with the night sky now?
I have an intimacy with the Milky Way in its hydrogen gas, but not as much with the night sky itself. You know, I live in Canberra. I look up and I see a few stars and I kind of, you know, forget about what it is. But I do have a sense of like exactly where we live in the Milky Way and what's around us. And it's a neighborhood that I know like the back of my hand, but I know it through the stuff that's between the stars rather than the stars themselves.
And is it the neighborhood of the southern skies? Because you came back to Australia to continue mapping your gigantic galactic atlas. Is it the southern skies you feel that intimacy with now?
It is definitely the southern skies. Because the southern skies are so much more exciting and interesting, that drew me back to Australia. But also, that's the part that I know so well.
And which neighbourhood of the Milky Way are you constantly drawn to?
Well, it's pretty hard to go past the galactic centre as the most amazing place. I mean, I guess we're drawn to it like we're drawn to huge metropolis like New York or Tokyo or something. You know, it's where everything's happening and it's dynamic and it's fantastic. So I do find that the center of the Milky Way is an amazing place. There's a lot of gas. There's a lot of stars. They're moving fast. Those stars are exploding. They're changing the environment rapidly. But it's really complicated. It's really hard to understand what's going on at the center of the galaxy.
So we come to 2004, and you're making this atlas of galactic hydrogen. That's when you found something new. How did that come about, Naomi?
Yeah, so in 2004, I found this bit of fluff, is the best way to describe it. it was a little bit of hydrogen gas, but it looked weird. I could see it in these movies of the gas in the Milky Way that I was creating, and there was this big, huge structure that was coherent, it was clear. And it was beyond where all the rest of the gas was. So it appeared to be sort of at the far edge of the galaxy.
And how are you observing this, though?
We took data with the Parkes telescope, and we create images, just like you have an image from your digital camera. We would create images, but images of gas. And these images are also made as movies. So what we see is gas moving at different speeds. And we would look to see how it was changing.
You meant to say these radio signals you're receiving through the Parkes telescope tell your computers that this means that this is located here and it forms an image based on those signals.
Yeah, exactly. So we make the images bright where there's a lot of gas and they're not very bright where there's very little gas. And it creates a complete picture of what the gas looks like.
And so you're seeing this smudge. And what did you think that smudge might be?
Well, I didn't really know what the smudge was at first, and I asked a bunch of people, and nobody really knew. And so I started putting together some sort of models, simple kind of toy models of our galaxy. And what I was trying to match was the spiral structure of our galaxy, so these whirlpool arms that our galaxy shows and many other galaxies show. I was trying to match those with what I was seeing in the hydrogen data. And they matched really well, like surprisingly well, that it seemed that the model that had a spiral arm at the furthest edge of the galaxy completely reproduced what I was seeing in these images. And so slowly, very, very, very slowly, it kind of dawned on me that what I was seeing was a new spiral arm in our galaxy that no one had ever seen before.
How many stars would be in this spiral arm?
Well, it's far out in the galaxy, and we have fewer and fewer stars the further out you go. So it is primarily a gas arm, and most galaxies show these sort of things. So you see gaseous arms that extend beyond where the stars are. But nonetheless, there would be, you know, thousands, many, many tens of thousands of stars in it.
Once you realized what you were looking at was a whole new spiral arm of the Milky Way galaxy, what kind of reaction did you get?
So I had a colleague of mine who realized that it was an exciting thing, whereas I was like, oh, yeah, I found this thing. It's a spiral arm. That's kind of cool. And he was like, oh, are you going to publish it in this incredible journal? And what's going to happen? And but I hadn't quite tweaked to that. But the astronomers are, you know, we're skeptical people. We're always very doubtful of things. So until there's extra proof, which did come later on, people were a little bit skeptical. But the media went crazy for this. The idea that there was a new spiral arm, it was really, really exciting media ride for me.
And what does that tell you about the kind of work you do, that response?
It reminds me of how much excitement and wonder there is in the general public about what's happening in the universe and what our galaxy looks like. It shows me that, you know, these things tweak the imagination of almost everybody, not just the inner 10-year-olds, in order to be really thrilled with new discoveries and the idea of mapping the heavens that really sits deep inside us.
I have my own theory on why people like this so much. And it goes along these lines, because the earliest models we had for how the universe worked, it had the Earth at the center of the universe with the planets and the sun and the moon rotating around it in, you know, these crystalline spheres, that which is a very beautiful, beautiful model of how the universe should work. But it's utterly not true, of course. And bit by bit, the Earth is being relegated further and further out towards the cheap seats of the universe. The universe has gotten a lot bigger. We realize we're a small planet rotating around the sun, a small sun, which is on the outer burbs of an arm of the Milky Way galaxy, which is a fair to middling galaxy in a cluster of super galaxies. And I think when you do things like this, when humans are able to find out things like this, you go, well, aren't we remarkable after all that we have the kind of minds and the science that can discover such things?
That's a nice way of thinking about it. It's true that it is kind of amazing that we're, you know, just one planet of billions in one galaxy of billions, and yet we're smart enough to be able to try to map out the universe to the very beginning and understand why it's expanding, to understand what galaxies look like, how they first came about, how stars form, how stars die. That's a lot of thinking.
Naomi, you just said one galaxy among billions. Is that just a figure of speech, or are we literally one galaxy? Is the Milky Way one galaxy literally among billions?
I'm afraid to say that it's true that the Milky Way is one galaxy among billions.
So you won the Prime Minister's Prize for Science for your discovery. And as a result, your family in the US decided to visit you in Australia. Was that a big decision for them to come all the way to Australia?
It was, especially for my mother. My father had visited Australia, but my mother didn't travel very well. And so it took, you know, the Prime Minister giving me a prize to get my mother here. But I don't think Australia really sat at her heart. I think...
Was she attacked by a croc or a python or something?
No, but she couldn't understand why people drove on the wrong side of the road. She really liked the fact that when you're exiting a car park, there's a sign that says way out, which being an old hippie, she thought that was really cool.
We drive on the correct side of the road. It's everyone else that drives on the wrong side of the road.
And as a physicist, it's all relative.
Indeed, that's right. You were with the CSIRO for many years. You're now with the Australian National University. How much have telescopes changed since you began as an astrophysicist?
Yeah, telescopes have changed a lot. We do a lot more of our observations remotely now. So when I was a wee PhD student, I would go to parks. I would sit underneath the dish as it moved and studied the bits of the galaxy that I was looking at. And you could feel the building move. It was a visceral experience. And now I sit at my kitchen table, I make dinner, and I observe remotely. And it doesn't have quite the magic that it had as a young PhD student. But on the other hand, we now are building huge new telescopes in places that we can't easily get to. And those telescopes are allowing us to see things with, you know, 100 to 1,000 times more detail and much more sensitive than they were when I started out. So things have moved very fast in the last 25 years.
The Square Kilometre Array is still underway at the moment. Can you explain what that is and what that will allow scientists like you to do and see?
Yeah, so the Square Kilometre Array is it's Australia's next great big science project. So this is a, you know, a 1.5 billion euro telescope that's being constructed in Western Australia and in South Africa. And it has many scientific objectives, but one of its objectives is to be able to see back to very close to the beginning of the universe, to the formation of the first stars, and to see how the structure of the universe set itself up at that time, and then how galaxies have evolved all the way from the first galaxies to our own Milky Way now, and how they've changed. So it's we'll be telling the history of our universe in hydrogen gas.
Do you expect to get a lot of surprises from when that data starts streaming in from the Square Kilometre Array?
Absolutely. You wouldn't build the telescope if you weren't expecting to get surprises. I mean, we joke in the sort of Donald Rumsfeld way that there's the known knowns and the, you know, known unknowns. There are things that we are unknown unknowns. We expect that we will find things that we weren't expecting to find. We just don't know what they are now.
Do you feel a sense of excitement about that, or dread may undo the work of a whole lifetime, the things you may discover from this?
I never even thought of feeling dread about it. I mean, the nature of science is that you sometimes do unravel previous things, but that's the marvel of it, is that it's a constantly evolving field. So I'm unbelievably excited about the things that we will find with the Square Kilometre Array. It's our opportunity to do things that in other galaxies, to be able to map other galaxies with the detail that we've been able to map our own. It sort of opens our eyes to the universe around us.
Naomi, I love talking about such things, and it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure, Richard. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
As Conversations fans, you love a fascinating character, and there are plenty in this story. Spies, lies and deception in an outback Australian town. The country's most secretive spy base is hidden on the fringe of Alice Springs. It's shaped a town, transformed war and continues to expand.
Pine Gap is almost certainly a prime nuclear target.
Come with me, Alex Barwick, to find out what on earth is happening in my backyard.
Why are there secrets that we shouldn't know? What are they?
Spies in the Outback. Check it out and subscribe on the ABC Listen app.